Gibeon is on the second hillside north of Jerusalem. If you take the road north along the hilltops from Jerusalem to Ramallah, and you go out beyond the new industrial park, which has been built just beyond the East Jerusalem line, you follow that road for some 10 minutes, you'll come to a little crossroad, and if you go west on that crossroad for about a mile, you'll arrive at a little Arab town, village really, called Enjib. And Enjib is the site of the ancient biblical city of Gibeon. Now, Gibeon was an important Canaanite town. It was one of the first towns which Joshua besieged after he had come through Jericho. And though the Bible lists many of these battles and these besieged towns, Gibeon is one that remains in mind because it was there that Joshua pleaded with God. Shemesh begivon dom, let the sun stand still in Gibeon, in the hopes that the day might be prolonged and he might be able fully to defeat the enemy. In Canaanite times, Gibeon was an important shrine, a high place. It seems to have retained this function in the Israelite era. We know that King Solomon went to Gibeon, to the high place of Gibeon, once he had been anointed as king, to offer there a thanksgiving offering to God. And it was there that he had his famous dream dialogue with God, in which God asked him, "Solomon, what can I give you?" And Solomon, who might have asked for great wealth or great power or grand victories, responded simply, "Lev Shomea," a heart skilled in listening, "in order that I might rule your people, in order that I might know the difference between the right and the wrong." The ability to listen, to be discerning in judgment, is surely one of the marks which separates out the capable ruler from the tyrant. And this was, of course, cited by God as proof of the king's wisdom. But I did not come to Gibeon, did not go to Gibeon 3 weeks ago because of its biblical references, nor to see the various archaeological sites which are available there for the visitor, particularly a large, round, circular pit or well, 40 feet in diameter, perhaps 80 feet deep, around which the Israelites had built a descending staircase. This was the passageway which went down to a long tunnel which went out then many, many hundreds of meters beyond the city walls to an underground spring. And it was in this way that those who were inside Gibeon could withstand a siege and have water available to them. I went to Gibeon not to see this famous well and not because Solomon had once been there, but because it was one of the settlements, one of the places in which new settlers, squatters, if you will, had come, in this case from Jerusalem, in order to establish a new community in the West Bank. I'd come with a lev shomea, a heart prepared to listen. I'd heard in Jerusalem all of the explanations by the foreign ministry of the settlement policies, and then I wanted to hear from the settlers themselves, because the question of the settlements in the West Bank, Gaza, and Golan is not simply a matter of official government policy. But in cases such as Gibeon, those who settle there have settled against the expressed decision of the government. They have looked the government in the eye and faced it down. And in order to understand their mood and some of the problems which any democratic leadership in Israel must face, I felt it was important to go and to listen, to try to understand. Now, in the Middle East today, or whenever there will be negotiations, either between Egypt and Israel or between Israel and any of the Arab countries, two issues will be at the base of all of these negotiations. The first is the issue of the status of the West Bank and of Gaza, that is, the status of the Palestinians, the political status. The second has to do with territory. What will be the boundaries of Israel once peace has been negotiated? And the second question is, of course, the issue of the settlements. Now, in the matter of the so-called Palestinian rights, The matter of the political configuration, which will have to be given to with the West Bank and or Gaza, the issue is not one that cannot be resolved. Clearly, there is some identity of interest between the United States and even Egypt and Jordan and Israel. For none of these countries want to see this territory precipitously given over to some kind of Palestinian government. Whatever government would be established there would be incapable of keeping out the most extreme terrorist groups within the Palestine Liberation Organization. The communities would be terrorized. Quickly, this would become a radical terrorist state armed by either by the Russians or the Chinese or by Libya, one which would destabilize, to use the heavy political word, destabilize all relationships in the Middle East and particularly undermine the security of Jordan and of Israel. And so it is clear that once some face-saving formula has been found so that the Arab states can claim that they have won back their rightful place, that the Palestinians have some kind of sovereignty, it is clear that the question of immediate independence for this particular part of the world will not be an issue which cannot be resolved. But on the issue of the settlements, Israel seems to be standing alone. Resolution 242 of the Security Council of the United Nations, which was the passed just after the Six-Day War in 1967, and which is really the governing body, the governing language for a Geneva conference or a Cairo conference, the language agreed upon by the consensus of the world community, speaks quite clearly of what it calls the inadmissibility of the acquisition of territory by war, and calls for the withdrawal of Israel's armed forces from territories occupied in the recent conflict. In the West, among your friends and mine, clearly there's a consensus that sees any attempt by Israel to maintain more than the most minor of border rectifications after a peace is established as unwarranted. As a matter of most people, many Jews cannot understand why Israel should be making such an issue of these settlements. After all, Gaza and the Sinai and the West Bank were not under Israel's sovereignty or authority until 10 years ago. The United States government shares generally the maximalist Arab view in this on this particular issue. You remember that after Mr. Begin visited President Carter earlier this year and went back and sanctioned three previously unsanctioned settlements in the West Bank, Secretary Vance spoke very clearly and very specifically when he said, "We have consistently stated that we, that is the United States, are of the opinion that the placing of these settlements is contrary to international law and presents an obstacle to peace." So clearly the issue of the settlements is at the base of many of the most tangled and difficult issues which will have to be negotiated. And I went to try and understand the equity and the right and what was involved generally. Let me give you a few basic facts. There are today about 90 settlements in land which was not Israel before 1967. 24 of these settlements are on the Golan, on the heights over Syria, in what was then Syria. About 20 of these settlements, 19 or 20, are in the Sinai, mostly near the Gaza Strip. Three or four along the west bank of the Gulf of Aqaba to protect the road which leads from Eilat down to that little island at the tip of the Gulf of Aqaba, which controls the access to the whole bay and through which Israel's oil supply comes. That is at Sharm el-Sheikh, and the rest of them are on the so-called West Bank, what Menachem Begin calls Judah and Samaria. Now, we talk of these as under a single category, settlements, and therefore these settlements seem all to have been conceived by the same program, to have been established in the same way, to have been essentially of the same order, and that's simply not the case. And one has to understand what is involved here, the complexity of what is involved here, to begin to disentangle the strains and to make up one's own mind. 90 settlements seem a lot, but there seem to be little more than 6,000 or 7,000 people involved in these 90 settlements. We're not talking of a major transfer of population. Some of them, like the little settlement in Gibeon that I went to visit, has only four families. The largest of these settlements at Yamit, which is in just beyond the Gaza Strip near the Mediterranean coast, has perhaps 400 families. Most are 4, 10, 12, and the like. There are three kinds of settlements. The first was established officially by the Israeli government and is part of the Israeli security system. After the war of 1967, you remember that the Arab states met at Khartoum and made it a matter of official policy, that there were to be no negotiations, no recognition, and no peace. And once Israel recognized that there would not be a peace, that there would not be negotiations after that conflict, obviously it became necessary for the Israeli government to make rather permanent security arrangements for the lands which were under its control. And so the Israeli Defense Forces established a set of paramilitary colonies in the Golan, along the west bank of the Jordan River, all the way from the Galilee down to the Dead Sea, and in the Sinai, protecting the Gulf of Aqaba and sealing off to a certain degree the population of the Gaza Strip from infiltration. These settlements are manned by members of the Nahal, which is the pioneer youth paramilitary group, which is part of the Israeli Defense Force. They are part of Israel's security system, and they are really not the issue when people talk about settlements, though they represent by far the largest number of the settlements. The land is being farmed. These settlements were established either in unused Jordanian army camps or in land which was ownerless, or the land was actually bought by the Israeli government. You remember about 6 months ago, President Carter, for a week or two, had a plan which would allow Israel to maintain some forward security positions during a period of transition to Palestinian independence in the West Bank. It is these settlements that he was speaking about. The existence of these settlements has proved the needs for security. If security can be secured in some other way, they can be dismantled. They are part of Israel's official policy and correspond and respond to whatever will be Israel's policy. The second group of settlements, much smaller number, perhaps four or five in number, are civilian settlements established with the authorization of the Israeli government on land by and large purchased by the Jewish National Fund, with funds which have been supplied by the Israeli government. And they are, for the most part, in places which Israel would like to believe will be given to Israel as part of border rectifications in a final peace treaty. Areas which, for one reason or another, need to be made secure. And Israel believes by establishing civilian centers in these areas, they are making their claim to what was heretofore an unused or undeveloped part of the world. Whether these claims will be able to be sustained in the final peace agreement remains to be seen, but the Israeli government has, in four or five cases, where the Jordan River enters into the Dead Sea, at the western tip of the Gaza Strip and elsewhere, established a settlement of some size in order to begin to have some kind of civilian position, civilian center, in this particular area, usually contiguous to present Israeli territory. Now, the last settlements are the settlements you read about. They are the so-called illegal settlements, though some of them have now been legalized or authorized. The first of these settlements was established 4 years ago at a place which was then called Kadum, which is ancient Samaria. It was established by a group who called themselves the Movement for Greater Palestine. They simply went out against the expressed will of their government, and they appropriated or expropriated an old, unused railroad station. They squatted there, and they began to establish a town. Prime Minister Rabin threatened to send in the army against them, and in the event, he proved not to have the will to do so. And though they were removed to a nearby little used Israeli army camp, they remained in place. They established their position. They began to farm the neighboring land. And when Menachem Begin came to power 8 months ago, this was one of the first of the communities which he authorized. There are perhaps 20, 25 such communities. Gibeon, where I visited, was one. These communities have been brought into being despite the position of the Israeli government, which does not allow Israelis to buy land from Arabs in the West Bank. You can option land, but you can't buy it, which is unhappy with the existence of Jewish settlements in the midst of areas which are impacted Arab settlement. But it's a case in which a group of ideologues, if you don't like them, you call them fanatics, went into an area and defied their own government, and their government proved not to have the will to remove them bodily from that particular place. Now, who are these ideologues or fanatics? They're essentially of two groups. One is a group who were followers in the pre-independence years of one of the great charismatic Zionist leaders, a man by the name of Jabotinsky, Vladimir Jabotinsky. Jabotinsky was perhaps the most charismatic of all of the Zionist leaders in the 20s and the 30s. He is a man who never made his peace with the first partition of Palestine, the partition of 1924, when the English government arbitrarily cut off all of East Jordan from the Palestine Mandate and brought up a little sheikh from the Hejaz, from Arabia, Abdullah, and gave him this land and said, Jordan is now your country and you are now its king. By the Balfour Declaration and the League of Nations Mandate, what is now Jordan was to be part of a Jewish national home, and Jabotinsky created a party called the Revisionists, determined to revise the 1924 decision. And the outgrowth of this revisionist group is the party which is known in Israel as the Herut, a party from which Menachem Begin led for so many years. It is a party which has from the very beginning been unhappy with the partition of 1947, called it half a loaf. And Israel, the Arabs, they keep saying, have 21 countries. Why can't we have all of ours? This is part of the group that went out to these new settlements. But the larger part is a group of Orthodox Jews, largely from the B'nai Akiva Moshavot, who have large support in the chief rabbinate and in the National Religious Party, who now call themselves the Gush Emunim, the Fidelity Group, who believe that they are literally faithful to the biblical covenant. In chapter 15 of the book of Genesis, God makes the original promise to the Jewish people, the original covenant with Abraham. And that promise, in that promise, God offers Abraham, by way of covenant, all of the Holy Land, which he describes as all the land of the Canaanites, the land which runs from the Euphrates to the river of Egypt, to the Wadi Yabuk. And these people believe that by biblical right, Israel ought to have sovereignty over the entire West Bank, because it is part of the covenanted land. And they have a great deal of support in the larger Orthodox community, and they have the manpower and the woman power to go out and to establish these settlements. Most in Israel would call the members of the Gush Emunim fanatics, because they've deliberately defied their own democratically elected government. They know better than the government. But at the same time, these few thousand ideologues and believers, true believers, would not have been able to defy the government if obviously there had not been broad support for at least the process of what they were involved in the country at large. I read recently an article which was published based on a poll taken by the School of Applied Social Work at Hebrew University just 4 weeks ago, which indicated that more than 70% of Israel's population agreed with the statement that no government of Israel should give back for any peace treaty all of the settlements which have been established in the lands taken in 1967. Now, the 70%+ of Israelis who more or less agree with the establishment of certain settlements beyond the borders are a mixed bag. Some of them, obviously, most of them, I'm sure, look upon this simply as a security matter. Mr. Alon, who first envisaged these Nahal settlements in the Jordan Valley, spoke of the need for a security belt. The Israelis live under the fear of infiltration every day. They know that Arabs cannot necessarily be taken at their word, because no politician, no country can be taken at its word. Politicians' words are designed in international affairs to have loopholes in them, all kinds of ways in which they can be broken. The security reason is the primary reason. But it's also true that even among those who are not true believers, there is a feeling that in the years after the Holocaust, no part of the world can be allowed to be Judenrein, much less part of the Holy Land. That there can be no place in Israel's ancestral home, whoever has sovereignty over that area, in which Jews should not be allowed to settle. The idea that part of this area is prohibited to Jews seems is in their minds a totally unacceptable and immoral statement. Arabs can live in Israel. Why can't Jews live in other parts of the Holy Land? And then, too, there are bitter memories. There's a sense of having returned. We forget that before 1947, there were sizable Jewish settlements in the West Bank. There was a settlement, an age-old settlement in Hebron. There was the major agricultural settlement at the Etzion block. There was Kiryat Arava. There was Beit Arava, a number of these. That were overrun by the Jordanian army, and the people fled back into Israeli territory during that war. To some, it's a sense of going home. Some of the people who've gone back to Etzion are the sons and granddaughters of the original settlers of the area. So the Israeli government has, to a certain degree, been paralyzed by public opinion. Even if it wanted to, it could not summarily dismantle these settlements, because there is the security reason, for the security reasons, and for emotional and historic reasons. Now, what did I find when I met with the people at Gibeon? I found a group of squatters who had come out about 4 months before and found this old, abandoned Jordanian army camp. They had whitewashed and replastered some of the buildings. They were there with their families. There were a number of children running around. The unofficial mayor of Gibeon, the leader of this expedition, was a man, in his late 50s. He was a Polish Jew from Warsaw who had been a disciple of Jabotinsky's. He'd been a member of Jabotinsky's youth group, Beitar. He had followed Begin and voted for Begin in all of the earlier Israeli elections. He was a blue-class worker. I think he'd worked with his hands on a farm as a mechanic in Haifa. He was a man who represented all that we mean when we speak of the pioneers who rebuilt Israel. He was a man who argued with me in rather broken English, because I had with me my clerical colleagues and we couldn't use Hebrew. He spoke with me about this being our land. The Arabs have 21 countries. This is our land. Publicly, we have a right to it. Privately, my wife went out, he told me, and she bought options on this land from the local farmers. It's never been a productive area. They brought the goat, they destroyed its fertility, and now they can make better money if they go into Jerusalem and work in the factories and in the city than if they remain on the farm. They're only too glad to sell it to us. We'll make it green again. By public right and by private work, this land is ours. He kept saying to me, we can get along with the Arabs. The problem is not the Arab, the problem is the Arab leader. The problem is the Arab leader, he kept saying, who is caught up in his own rhetoric, who loves to hear his own voice, and he becomes more and more belligerent, more and more expansive, more and more demanding the longer he talks. And we'd had, just before this visit, we'd had an example of this, because we'd spent about an hour with the Arab mayor of Ramallah, who is a member of the PLO. And as he talked with us, he talked for a whole hour without interrupting himself. He became more and more, you know, grandiose in his demands, less and less peaceful, less and less open, less and less willing to negotiate with Israel. But in any case, to this man, this is simply his land. And if his government doesn't see it this way, he knows better than his government. He doesn't understand Begin, this man who all his life has been devoted to the greater Israel idea, who suddenly, when he comes to power, believes that he can achieve by negotiation security and peace. You can't negotiate, he said. Yes, they'll sign some papers or make some statements, and then the minute we retreat to the 67 borders, they'll make some more statements and demand some more land. He's there. He's working. He's establishing a new set of facts. The people whom I met are simple people. Two of the families whom we met were new Olim from Eastern Europe. They're willing to do what their grandfathers and fathers did a generation or two before, go out with their hands and try and make the land green and establish a city. They have no money. Each of them has put up 150 Israeli pounds to be part of this expedition, which is less than $10. They have some support, obviously, in the larger community enough to give them the money to option the land. The leader's life savings has gone into this project. And they are determined to face the Israeli government with a fait accompli. Why should we not be able to live here? Why is this not part of the land that is ours? Now, when, as you know, the recent meetings between Egypt and Israel broke up 10 days ago, the pretext for that breakup had to do with settlements such as Gibeon. The foreign minister of Egypt, Mr. Gamel, had arrived in Israel and at the airport had delivered a very strong set of absolutist demands. Peace cannot come until Israel has withdrawn totally from all of our lands. And Dayan, and then later in a toast, Mr. Begin had responded very strongly to this kind of return to the rhetoric of that Sadat had used before the meeting of the Knesset, the demand for the ultimate demand for all of the Arab requirements, land, return of the 67 borders, Palestinian rights, Eastern Jerusalem, and the like, as if a whole set of very special negotiations, very difficult, very specific negotiations, had not gone on in the intervening time. The negotiations broke up on the issue of the settlements. And when Mr. Gamel was recalled to Cairo, Sadat went before a meeting of the National Parliament of Egypt, you recall, and he drew cheers upon cheers when he said, I will not allow a single Israeli soldier or a single Israeli civilian to remain on our soil. The issue of the settlements was once again raised in the arena of public opinion. Now, again, we run into complications. We run into the complications of that are typically Middle Eastern. That is, nothing is as simple as we would like it to be. We're children of the frontier. We went out from the eastern seaboard into the open land, and whatever land we came to was bare. It was without history. The only history it had was the history of the nomadic peoples, the Indians, and we pretended that they were non-people. And there was no history to deal with here in the Midwest or in the Far West, and therefore problems had a certain simplicity to them that could be solved. But in the Middle East, every square meter of land has 4,000 years of history, 4,000 years of complexity. Nothing can be solved quite that simply. And really what the settlements issues have done is to make the world recognize, and hopefully to, I hope that Sadat will recognize, that these issues cannot be dealt with, you know, offhandedly, broadly. Sadat came to Egypt and said, to Israel and said, I'm here, I've broken through the non-nothingness of Israel. I've recognized, in a sense, Israel. And now, in return, you must be as generous as I and give me all that I ask. But it simply can't be done that way. One has to deal with these issues piecemeal, one by one, looking each of them at each of them as they come. Unfortunately, the Israeli domestic political scene, which is not a very pretty one always, had given to Sadat the pretext for this action. When Sadat had come to Jerusalem, Israel had made a peace proposal which, as you know, recognized returned to Egypt full sovereignty over all of Sinai. But within that offer was the agreement, or the attempt to forge an agreement, which said that the Egyptian armies would not go beyond a certain line which would be drawn in the Sinai, and the rest of it, the 100 kilometers which are parallel to the Israeli border, to the border of Gaza, would remain demilitarized. There are a number, perhaps 8 settlements, which the Israelis have set up around the tip of the Gaza Strip to prevent infiltration into that area from the Sinai. The Gaza is the only occupied area of the Sinai. It's a heavily populated area. And the Israelis have been concerned that this area not be infiltrated and be used as a base for action against Israel. Tel Aviv is only 20 miles away. Now, unfortunately, once this proposal was made in good faith, I believe, because Dayan went immediately down to this area and spoke to the settlers there and told them that if they stand in the way for peace, Israel cannot defend them, that Israel will, in a sense, extend its protection, its army's protection to them, but they may have to recognize titular sovereignty by Egypt. Though this was done, there is within the governing coalition a group of people who are determined that there really should be no withdrawal. And their leader in this case is a man named Ariel Sharon, a general in the army during the 1967 war, an old-time xenophobic leader who went out, you may remember, and began to talk to the press about a plan to place 2 million Jews in the occupied areas. Well, this was before Sadat had come to Jerusalem. After Sadat had come to Jerusalem, he began leaking to the press who had flocked there from all parts of the world that the fact that Israel was proposing to establish new settlements near the Gaza. These settlements were before the cabinet. They had not been voted on. They have not been voted on. But Sharon was making mischief, determined to undo what Menachem Begin was trying to do. And he managed to have his way, in the sense that the government was not strong enough to absolutely and categorically deny Sharon and or to dismiss Sharon from office, and from the point of view that not having done that, Sadat could have his issue. You're trying to make new facts. You're trying to undo the peace even as you are talking about peace. Now, Sadat did not recall Gamal because of the issue of settlements. That's clear. Sadat wanted a break, I believe, in these negotiations because he wanted to, one, reestablish his position within the Arab world as a strong and staunch defender of Arab rights. This allowed him to make a bombastic speech before his own parliament in which he proclaimed himself as the champion of the traditional Arab cause. It gave him a cause which he knew would have appeal throughout the West, because the West generally agrees that Israel ought not to have settlements outside of its own borders. And it allowed him to bring to the West a shopping list. You know, if you go into an Arab market, into the Shuk, and you see something that you like, you bargain a bit for it, and then you leave, because obviously the price that's being offered to you is too high. And then after you leave, if the man who owns the piece wants to make the sale, he comes to you, and to bring you back in, he offers you some coffee. He offers you a present. And then you come in and the bargaining goes on from there. What Sadat was doing essentially was to leave the bargaining table, but not break off the negotiations completely, and say essentially, I have to be bribed back to it. Because what was the message that he delivered to Secretary of State Vance? Not that Israel is making unconscionable demands, not that the settlement issue cannot be resolved, but I need arms. I have a shopping list of modern weapons which I require for my armed forces. I know that the new foreign aid bill is now before the House and the Senate. And in his speech, he talked about the $1 billion worth of foreign aid that America had given to Egypt each of the past 3 years. He thanked America gratefully for our largesse. And he said, essentially, I need more arms and more aid. And that's why negotiations between Israel and Egypt are being resumed in Washington next week, because he wants his coffee. He wants more arms and he wants more aid. He wants to be brought back into the negotiations in that way. And there's more to it than that. By opposing Sadat's Egypt's largesse, his generosity of spirit, his willingness to open up new avenues for arrangement and negotiation, to Israel's hard bargaining, he was able to play on one of the oldest anti-Semitic stereotypes in the world. Not that he ever uttered it himself. But there's no free press in Egypt. And Begin was quick to point out that immediately upon Gamel's recall, the Egyptian press began an orchestrated attack on Menachem Begin and on Israel, using all of the old images of Shylock, of the Jew as the money grubber, the Jew as the traitor. A man named Anis Mansour, ten days ago, writing in Al-Aram, which is the semi-official, completely censored government paper, wrote about Jews, about Israel. Bargaining, trickery, and calculations of profit and loss are part of their character, and they are incapable of change. He was able to put out to the world the image, in other words, of the Jew, of Begin, of Israel, as demanding every bit of coin it could get, instead of having the largeness of spirit, which would allow for true, meaningful negotiations. Sadat will reopen the peace negotiations. He needs to. He's going to get his pound of flesh in Washington, and his shilling of flesh in London, and his mark of flesh in Bonn. But then he'll go back, that's clear. But the settlement issue still remains. And it will have to remain in the difficult bargaining that lies ahead. Once Sadat goes back, or once Gamel goes back for Sadat, they have admitted that they have now moved beyond the area of broad pronouncements, of simple solutions, down to the nitty-gritty. And once one gets to that level, then every settlement, every issue must be analyzed. Clearly, there are settlements which ought to be removed, which are provocative, which ought never have been placed there in the first place, which were placed there despite the desire of the Israeli government, which have nothing to do with security. And clearly, unless Israel is truly determined on an expansionist policy, the thing the Arabs claim, some of these settlements will have to be removed. Clearly, some of these settlements will simply wither on the vine. Their reason for being will dissipate if, in fact, there is some kind of security in that region for any length of time. But with equal certainty, it can be said that any number of these settlements will have to remain for a long period of time, until the other temporary structures which are established, as far as Palestinian rights and the like, have a chance to work themselves out, until Israel no longer needs these forward warning bases for its own security. You can't say I'm for the settlements or I'm against the settlements. You have to talk of each settlement and its purpose within the larger issue of security and of peace. Are the settlements an obstacle to peace, as Mr. Vance has at times claimed them to be? Obviously, they're an obstacle to peace if the Arabs determine them to be so, declare them to be so. But in point of fact, many of them may make a contribution to a negotiated settlement insofar as they contribute to the security of the whole area. Now, the Israeli government of Mr. Begin has yet to show that it can bite the bullet as far as any of these settlements are concerned. Begin comes out of a world which is the world of the greater Palestine, of the whole land movement. He instinctively responds to the idea of all of Israel by right, Israel. But at the same time, he governs and ministers a state which cannot have its way simply because it wants it. If there is to be negotiation, he will have ultimately argue for the dismantling, at least of the illegal settlements of Kadum, Elon Mogreh, and the like, and Gibeon. Will he do so? I don't know. That will be the ultimate test of his leadership, of his vision, and of his power. But at some point, that issue is going to be placed squarely before this Israeli government, and will have to be met. And I hope when it does that he, like Solomon, will have the lev shomea, the heart which is capable of listening to voices other than the voices which speak to him of expansion and of territory